Good morning. Welcome to hour number two, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you here. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. And we are also pleased in this hour of the program to welcome back here to the show Bob Crawford, a guy who was a very important part of the radio scene in the city of Chicago for a long time. If you listen to radio in Chicago, if you listen to news radio, you heard this man for more than 40 years. He reported on Chicago politics at the CBS radio affiliate there, WBBM, most notably on their very popular program At Issue. He went to work there in 1968 after they heard some of his coverage of the trial of mass murderer Richard Speck when Bob was working for a station in Peoria. In 1980, he joined the CBS team at the White House and provided reports to all the network stations during the final days of the Carter administration through the release of the hostages that were being held in Iran and the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. He had his education in journalism here at the University of Illinois. He graduated in 1959, worked as a student here at WYLL, at also WPGU and WCIA-TV. In 1995, he was inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame, and he retired in 2001, but continues to be active. And one of the things that he did after he retired was that he took a tremendous amount of audio material that he had collected over the time that he'd been a reporter in Chicago and gave it to the University of Illinois. And it is available online. So if you have the right stuff on your computer, you can go and you can hear a lot of really fascinating material. A lot of it is about Chicago politics specifically. Many cuts there from the first Mayor Daley, Harold Washington, Mike Bolandic, Jane Byrne, many members of the city council, the governor's father-in-law. I think you can hear him there.
Right.
And also other cuts from all of the people that have been governor in this period and other things too. A lot of really interesting material there. And when Bob was here back in the spring, we're talking a little bit about journalism and about some of his experiences. I said, well, it'd be great if you could come back and let's play something for people. And he said, yes, of course he would do that. And we're pleased that he is here this morning. And we'll do that. We'll play some selections from the Crawford Audio Archives for people to get a chance to hear. And of course, as we move here through the hour as well, if folks want to call in, well, they can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's nice of you to have me back.
You probably didn't save everything. How did you think about what you were going to save through all that time?
Well, you know, it goes to the notion of what I thought a journalist needed to be, and that is not just someone who reported facts of a story and then just let it sit out there and let the people figure out how it affected them in their daily lives. I also thought that a reporter had to be analytical and to try to educate and enlighten the audience as well as to inform them. And I realized as time went on, David, that if I was going to do that, I had to keep some kind of an audio file so that I could use that material in providing a perspective on various issues and how the position of politicians had changed on those issues over the years, for better or for worse, so on and so forth. And so these archives came about by necessity, really, to help me with my analytical reporting and explanatory journalism. And I set the archives up in such a way that I could access material very quickly if I was doing a special piece on how someone's point of view had changed on an issue or how the Chicago City Council might be doing a flip on a particular issue. They went one way one time and another way the other time. I would bring out some of the old tape and try to play it to show how the views had changed over time and to give people a better perspective. And so the archives were really living archives in the sense that I used them every day of my career. And then when I retired, I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do with all of this material? Am I just going to put it on a shelf and let it gather dust? And so I talked with a few political science professors from the U of I who said to me, you know what, that material would be very beneficial to someone like me. If I was going to write a book someday, I would want to know not only what someone said about a particular issue, but how they said it. Because as we all know, David, when politicians speak, oftentimes how they say something is just as important as what they say. And so I'd like to feel that these I decided to donate the archives to the library. And I'd like to feel that what they do is they're not the last word by any means on the history of that period. But what they do is raise the level of accuracy in reporting on that period. I think political scientists and historians who come to this file wanting to know exactly how Richard J. Daley phrased his shoot-to-kill order in 1968, for example, which he was roundly criticized for, can get the shoot-to-kill order in his own words. They can hear what he said, how he said it, was he serious, so forth. They can also hear speeches of him defending that decision in the face of worldwide criticism, even though he later backed off of that order, and things like that. So I think it improves the accuracy of the accounts that political scientists and historians will offer. You know, I remember someone saying once that if history is not done right, it can be a bad joke played by the present on the past. And I'd like to think that these archives make a contribution to preventing that from happening.
Yeah. Well, we have pulled a few things that we'd like to play, and there, I'm not exactly sure why we've chosen some of these things, because there is a lot of material here, and you know, perhaps on another day you can go back and we can even do some more. But certainly, we wanted to play something from the first Mayor Daley, and I'm sure that you would say that of all of the people that you covered in all of the time you were covering Illinois and Chicago politics, he must be the figure that looms the largest. There's just nobody can touch him.
Yeah, I think that's quite true, and for a couple of reasons, really, and that is that when I covered Richard J. Daley, he was at the peak of his power. He was the last of the big city political bosses running the last of the big city political machines, and his power was really something to behold. This was a man who, as a mayor, mind you, could pick up the telephone and call President Lyndon Johnson at the White House, and the secretary would put him through right away. There was no talking to an intermediary aide. He could talk right to the president if he had something that he needed to discuss with him. He was that important politically. And so when you covered Richard J. Daley, you had the feeling that whenever any significant events occurred, that you were not only reporting a good story, but you, in a sense, were being a witness to history. Mm-hmm. And you don't forget that very easily when you cover a man like him. For better or for worse, he was a fascinating figure.
Let's play this first cut, 22039. This is probably one of the most famous things that he ever said, that people will, of all the things, if you don't remember anything else that he ever said, this people remember.
Right.
Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
This falls under the category of sometimes Richard J. Daley would get his syntax mixed up, but even though you didn't always understood what he said, you understood what he meant. And he was defending the police back in the days when lawsuits were being filed against the police department for illegal spying by a group in the department that was known as the Red Squad. And they were doing a lot of nasty spying on protest groups and so forth. There was always a certain dislike for outsiders in the Daley years, you know. And, of course, all these protesters were outsiders who would come to the city like they did in 68, and they disrupted the 68 convention. So there was always a lot of suspicion on what they were up to. And Daley was defending the police department in the face of these lawsuits saying, you know, they're not there to create disorder. They're there to preserve order is what he meant. But it came out the wrong way. And you're right. It is one of the funniest things that ever happened with him.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just play the other cut why don't we just play this and then we can come back and you can set the context for it.
And the phony question and charges of fraud has been as evident today as it was 30 or 40 years ago. And they haven't proved a damn thing. They hollered fraud in 1960 on Kennedy. And when it came time, this Democratic Party, if you will, agreed to pay half the cost of counting all the ballots in the state of Illinois, and we will turn down by the Republican Party. Is that fraud? What kind of fraud is it? It's mental fraud on themselves.
I love that logic, mental fraud
mental
on themselves.
Mental fraud on themselves.
Throughout his career, Mayor Richard J. Daley never failed to rise to the defense of his political organization, despite all of the corruption, despite all of the obvious vote fraud that was actually occurring. He always defended the organization to the nth degree. That excerpt you just heard was one of many speeches he often gave before the organization in the days before an election, where he would try to fire up the troops to get out there and work, get the adrenaline flowing. And so he would give these fiery, fist-pounding addresses, which were deliberately intended to keep all of the loyalists focused on the upcoming election and to get the vote out. And whenever it got around to giving a speech like that, always in his mind was the criticism the machine constantly faced about vote fraud. And there you have him defending the machine. And when he talks about paying half the cost, by the way, he's referring to the 1960 election between Nixon and Kennedy, where Kennedy narrowly won the election and carried Illinois. And there were accusations galore that Daley's machine had stolen the election for Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And what happened was Daley found out that Nixon didn't have any interest in any recounts anywhere because he had already lost the state of Texas, too. He had lost the election. He saw no point in it. So Daley took advantage of that and offered to pay half the cost of a recount that he knew wasn't going to happen. And then he turns it around, as he did in this speech, very cleverly, I must say, to say, well, if we're committing fraud, why would we have been willing to pay half the cost of a recount in the 60 presidential election? Well, he knew there wasn't going to be one anyway. Mm. So there was nothing wrong with doing that.
He was certainly a very colorful figure, said all kinds of wonderful things. Now, and his son, I think, certainly has something of the talent for mangling the language that his dad had, not quite up to the same level.
He does.
I guess, and it is true that to this day, people in public life often say stupid stuff that they wish that they could take back. But I do wonder, do you think that today's politicians are more guarded in what they say than were people like the first Mayor Daley? And you go back a while. It seems like now, and I don't know if it's because they have handlers that are always trying to protect them from making a mistake, mm-hmm. but that I think now people are they're much more careful about what they say than they used to be.
I think that's basically it. You put your finger right on the important point, and that is nowadays campaigns are over-organized. The candidates all have consultants who are advising them on what to say, how to say it, and do not vary from the message. No matter what the question is, just say a few things to acknowledge the question, then get back into the talking points we all agreed on before the campaign started. Do not ever waver from that. And that's the reason why you see fewer mistakes. But you also see less real dialogue and debate, too. If you look at the so-called candidate debates nowadays, like for governor and president, it's all rehearsed stuff. And I think people come away from it saying, oh, for heaven's sakes, somehow I had the feeling that wasn't really a debate at all. And the debates have turned into the candidates trying to reinforce the loyalty of their political base by saying the same things they're saying on the campaign trail, no matter what the correspondents might ask. Now, once in a while, there are mistakes, but they're not natural, you know. The guy just forgot what the consultant told him to say, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So in the old days, what I'm saying is the dialogue, for better or worse, was a lot more natural, I think, than it is now. Now it's so rehearsed, you know, that you don't really get an awful lot that's new, really, yeah. in the way of original thinking.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that I'm sure one of the things that you did when you were a reporter and you had the opportunity to ask questions of the mayor or anybody else is that what you try to do is maybe hit them with something that they're not really expecting. Your advantage is, and if you can catch them off guard, just the tiniest bit, so they don't have an automatic response. So they say, okay, this is question number 14, and this is the response.
That's right.
And it's also, I think it's getting harder and harder to do that as well, to get to in a real unscripted moment.
It is really, because they are so much on guard, you mm-hmm. know, and whenever you stick that microphone out there, they are even more on guard, you know, when you're asking questions. And I would try to use different techniques to try to get at more information, really, not to get them to mess up. That wasn't my goal. My goal was to try to elicit the information that I knew they had, but which they didn't want to offer, because some consultant had told them, if you do this, you'll lose this segment of the electorate, and you don't want to do that, you know. But whenever I did interviews with candidates, I didn't use that technique too often. My view was that the best way, the art of the interview was in being a good listener, not a talker. Mm-hmm. Ask the question, let the people speak, let them say what they want to say, and then every so often just try to interject questions that are designed to try to get more information, but not to force them into making mistakes and making fools of themselves, because that's not what the goal of a reporter should be. The goal of a reporter should be to get the important information out of there, no matter how it is said.
We have a caller here we want to bring in, and also I should introduce again our guest, Bob Crawford, a man who spent a long time, several decades, in the city of Chicago covering Chicago and Illinois politics, working for WBBM AM radio. Imagine that, AM radio, the CBS affiliate there in Chicago. He retired in 2001, and when he retired, he had a lot of audio material, more than 58 hours of tape, that he gave to the University of Illinois Library, and it is now online, so if people want to go there and look at it and listen to it, they can. And we thought it'd be interesting to have Bob come back and talk a little bit about some of the material and play some. We also will take calls, as always, and we've got somebody here in Urbana to talk with. Let's do that. This is line one.
Hello. Good morning, Mr. Crawford. I hope you can comment on two politicians from the Republican Party that were hugely significant in Illinois. One, Senator Everett M. Dirksen, whose entire career has been reduced to a quip about, you know, and when you spend billions, that's real money. But
A billion here, a billion
there.
Famous
lives.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then our longest-serving governor, Big Jim Thompson, who was also part of the 9/11 commission. And I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say about both men.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't want to appear to just suggest that all I did was cover Democrats. I covered many Republicans as well. Let me start with Everett Dirksen. I began covering him when I was a Cub reporter, just starting out in the business myself, but I found him to be a very fascinating figure. One of the most knowledgeable men I ever met on government and on the history of government. He believed that history was important, that it often pointed the way to how you had to do things in the future. And I always admired his command of things that had happened over the last 20 or 30 years when he was talking about what needed to be done on an issue. And I remember very well how it was Everett Dirksen who marshaled the votes that were necessary to get the Civil Rights Act passed. Without the work that Everett Dirksen did to try to persuade Republicans who really didn't basically like that legislation that it was the right thing to do, it wouldn't have passed. And Lyndon Johnson later gave credit to Everett Dirksen, saying he was one of the keys, otherwise the bill never would have passed. And so he will forever deserve credit for helping to get that Civil Rights Act passed, even though many people don't really understand to this day what his role really was. He was also a very colorful figure. You mentioned the line about a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money. He was complaining, of course, about the waste in the national budget and how members of Congress would tend to load up the budget bills with pork. And pretty soon, you know, there was so much of it, there was like a Christmas tree that was going to fall over, you know. A man who understood the art of humor, by the way, as we can talk more about this as we go along. Humor is very important in politics. And so he often mixed wit with seriousness in a way that I had never heard anybody else do it. And that's why Everett Dirksen was such a unique figure, because he was so different. Not only that, he was a powerful figure in Washington. Jim Thompson deserves a lot of credit, not just for the things he did as governor, but I remember when he was the U.S. prosecutor in the city of Chicago. And he was the first prosecutor, by my memory, to take new federal statutes that would get the U.S. prosecutor's office involved in local criminal behavior, such as vote fraud, for example, in the city of Chicago. It was Jim Thompson who began the prosecution of precinct captains on vote fraud charges, who went after people on corruption charges. He put away a number of politicians who had been getting away with murder, really, almost, for years. And he set a whole new tone in the U.S. Attorney's Office for independently going after people. And, of course, he built that reputation in such a way that he was able to use it to run for governor of the state of Illinois. So Jim deserves a lot of credit for cleaning up government back in those days when he was a U.S. attorney. As the governor, I suppose a lot of people could argue with what he did right or what he did wrong. He was in office 14 years. He had a long record. And I suspect a lot of people would say he did a lot of good things, maybe some bad things. He was a strong supporter of political patronage, like Richard J. Daley, which is sort of interesting. He fought in court against a decree that finally came down that ended political hiring and firing in state government. He just thought patronage was okay so long as the people you put into the jobs were theoretically qualified. He knew they weren't always qualified, but he was also smart enough to know that if you didn't have patronage, it would affect the kind of organization and loyalty you could put together that would keep reelecting you to office. In that sense, I found it fascinating that Jim Thompson's belief on the art of politics was very close to Richard J. Daley's belief about what you had to do to succeed, minus the vote fraud, but the understanding of power and how it comes about. It comes about through mutual loyalty, and that patronage was kind of a glue that held it all together. Jim Thompson kind of more or less believed that as Richard J. Daley did, although, of course, there were a lot of differences as well. Jim Thompson was very good at lobbying, too, to get bills, to get the bipartisan votes necessary through the legislature. He was the guy who started the practice of going right down on the floor of the House or the Senate in the last days of the session and twisting arms right in front of the TV cameras to try to get the votes to put on a bill. He was very, very involved in running government, and to his credit, I think.
We have a cut of kind of a funny cut of Jim Thompson, if the callers wouldn't mind waiting for a second, that Jim Thompson at the Illinois State Fair 1989, whether this is kind of funny, we thought we'd play that.
Well, he was bought in Indiana in April of this year, but he's been fed Illinois corn ever since. And it's sort of like Abraham Lincoln, you know. He was born in Kentucky, spent a few years in Indiana, but when he came to Illinois, he became great. And he's an Illinoisan. He's not a Hoosier. He's not a Kentucky. No matter how much those two states try to lay some claim to Abraham Lincoln. Well, if they can't claim Abraham Lincoln, they can't claim this grand champion Barrow either.
Are you saying Lincoln was a pig, Governor?
No. Oh. I'm saying you have to keep that historical lesson in mind, that in this mobile society of ours with people crossing from border to border, it's where you do your best work that determines what you are. And this Barrow obviously did his best work in Illinois because that's where he became the grand champion. Before that, he was just a pig.
He's talking about the grand champion pig.
It was a Gurk sow. He was sitting in a pen. It was a photo op in front of the Tribune Tower in Chicago. And the scene itself was hilarious because the pig is standing in the pen. He doesn't want to be in the pen, and so he's grunting his head off. And Jim Thompson shows up. Hi, fellas. How are you? And he's going to do this photo op, and the pig is grunting, and Jim Thompson's talking, and there's traffic going by, and everything you could think of. But to Jim Thompson's credit, he never missed a beat. You notice that you talk about an unusual question, David. The reporter says, are you calling Abe Lincoln a pig?
Yeah.
He doesn't miss a beat. He just says no and goes right on and offers a further explanation. There was a guy, by the way, who was good on his feet, about as good as you can get.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with someone else here. Let's see. Eureka, line number four, right here. Hello.
Excellent show, David. Could I just have a comment and a question?
Sure.
I remember reading a book about Dirksen, and I think somebody asked him what his net worth was, and his answer was between $1 and $5 million.
It sounds like some real money to me.
Oh yeah. my question is: I know Mr. Crawford was at WMBD in Peoria, and I wonder if he could, number one, just recall the mood around the spec trial, and number two, just any recollections he has of his reporting while he was at WMBD.
Well, thank you very much. This tests my memory a bit because it goes back a lot of years. The Speck trial was a very difficult case to cover. There had been a lot of publicity about the case when Speck was arrested, and, of course, the horrifying death that those student nurses had met was in and of itself something that would shake you, and you could never forget it as the trial was going on. You know, you could never forget what it was that had happened. And a lot of people might be interested to know how it was that the Speck trial came to be held in Peoria, and it was that a judge in Chicago ruled that there had been so much publicity about the case before the trial came around that it might be impossible to get a jury whose members had not heard one way or another about the case and might have been affected by it. In other words, you couldn't get an objective jury. And so they granted a change of venue to Speck's lawyer, and they moved the case down to Peoria, and they held it at the courthouse there. And, of course, security was very, very tight. I still remember to this day when they would bring Speck to the courthouse across the street from the county jail, which was just on the other side of the plaza that was around the courthouse there. They walked him over one day. Then they decided, oh, my God, we better not do that. Somebody might, you know, literally try to do harm to him. And they were dragging him so much that he almost fell down because he was cuffed to two different sheriff's deputies. Then they started to bring him in a van. They brought the van around, and then he would only have a short walk from the van into the building very quickly and then into the trial. My recollections of it, a very, very hard case to cover because of what happened, basically. You know, it was just the whole thing was just so shocking. And as I heard the testimony coming out from the various witnesses, I mean, it was even more so to hear their exact words. And I'll never forget Corazon Amaral. I still remember her name. She was the one nurse who survived it all, who would hid under a bed and watched everything unfolding, can you imagine? And she spoke in broken English, but in a way you could still understand her, very soft-spoken. She just laid the whole case out about what happened, a devastating testimony against Speck. And then William Martin, who was the attorney, said to her, "And do you see that man you were talking about in this room?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "You know, you are small." She was behind the microphone. He said, "Will you come out from behind there and show us who it is?" And she came out from behind the microphone, and as petite and as little and as unassuming as she was, she courageously lifted her hand, pointed her finger directly at Speck, and said, "That's the man." And that was the most dramatic moment in the whole trial. And on my days of reporting in Peoria, you know, Peoria was always a very competitive market. It was a great place to learn how to be a journalist. And I will ever thank myself for having worked there, because it taught you how to compete with others from across the street who worked for other stations and how to handle that competition in a way where you could still get the story done right, you know, and meet all the deadlines as well. Great, great training ground Peoria was, and I would imagine it probably still is to this day.
WMBD produced a number of people like Jack Brickhouse and other people, I believe.
That's correct, they did. I did not know Jack when he was there, but of course I knew about Jack.
Uh-huh.
And later when I met Jack a few times in Chicago, we joked about both having worked at the same station, and we came to the same conclusion that we did a lot of growing up as journalists for having worked there in those days because of the competition and how healthy it was.
I always remember your reporting from WBBM, and I always enjoyed it, Joyce.
Well, thank you very much. It's kind of you to say that.
Thank you.
We have another call we'll get to in just a second. Let me reintroduce our guest, Bob Crawford. He did indeed report on Chicago politics at the CBS radio affiliate WBBM for many years, covering many mayors, many city councils, many politicians, many governors. He retired in 2001. He, in 1995, was inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame, as the caller said. Before going to WBBM, he worked at WMBD in Peoria. He went to school here at the University of Illinois, earned a journalism degree in 1959, began his broadcasting career while he was a student, working for WILL, also worked at WPGU and WCIA-TV. And when he retired, he gave his audio archives, more than 58 hours of material, to the University of Illinois Library. And it is accessible online, so it is possible to go and hear some of the material. And we played a little bit this morning. We'll play some more for you. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Question here, someone in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Can I discuss career paths, maybe nowadays when there's a lot of television and so forth, compared to like what's depicted in the movie The Front Page, where there were five or so competing papers? Because recently a New York paper said Chicago style, whatever that is, journalism, has declined ever since Royko moved to the suburbs. And a Chicago paper had a columnist say, "What? That's news to us, you know."
Well, I think there was a question in there somewhere about how it's changed. And, right. of course, journalism is bound to change. The technology is different for one thing. But I'll tell you one thing that hasn't changed, and that is the competitive nature of journalism in Chicago. I mean, you have all of the major network TV stations represented there. You have a number of radio stations, including the one I worked at, WBBM, which puts regularly 12 to 14 reporters in the field every day. And you have two vibrant newspapers still competing against one another in an age where many cities, unfortunately, have become one newspaper towns. And I think it's unfortunate when that happens. No way to prevent it. But so we still have two newspapers in Chicago. So it's a lively competitive atmosphere. And I think the public cannot help but benefit from all of those different sources for information, because I've always been of the view that you should never form your opinions on the basis of just reading one paper or just listening to one station. You should try to broaden your horizons and listen to a lot of different points of view, watch a lot of different people on TV, read both newspapers, read different columnists, conservative and liberals, and then make up your mind, because usually the truth is somewhere in between. It's rarely ever on the right or the left.
Mm-hmm. Well, other questions are welcome. If you'd like to give us a call, talk with our guest, Bob Crawford, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit earlier about Jim Thompson and about the fact that I think some people in assessing his time as governor would say he did some good things, he did some bad things. I think one of the things that people have been critical of him for was the fiscal condition of the state when he left office and what it was that Jim Edgar had to deal with when he became governor. Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to play a cut here of Mr. Edgar talking about some of those same issues. I think maybe we'll wait a second here because Jason was dealing with a caller there. This is 70026, if we could play that.
To some extent, we do have to react. I mean, I can't control the economy. When I became governor, the paramount issue was the state's financial condition. We'd overspent. We were in the midst of a recession, and we had to take action. Now, I view it as visionary. If your vision is to try to have a balanced budget and try to, you know, stop overpromising and try to keep the state afloat financially. And I think we've done that. And that has been a very difficult, because you've had to say no to a lot of people. You've had to restructure programs. Now, there's a host of programs we've initiated, like Earn Fair and others, that are major changes. The fact we've gone from general assistance for able-bodied men and women to saying, here, we're going to put you in a job position where you can learn the skills and have a permanent job. To me, that's a major change. And there's other things like that. But when the ship is beginning to sink because of the financial problems, you got to bail water. And just to keep the ship afloat, to me, is an accomplishment and something we've been able to do without doing what most other states have done, and that's raise the state taxes.
Now, what Jim Edgar was doing there was defending his frugal management of state government in the midst of criticism that while it's okay to say no, he was saying no way too much. Even to the point where some critics said we didn't even have a decent road program going and we were losing some matching federal funds. That was the complaint, because there just wasn't enough being done, and that what Jim Edgar was doing is he was balancing the budget okay, but the resources were not being used or improved upon in ways that needed to be done, for example, like for education, where the costs keep going up and up. So he was responding to that and saying it's not wrong to say no when you inherit big budget problems and you're trying to work your way through them. Now, it is true from what you said, David, that Jim Thompson left the state with a rather large deficit. But one thing you'll notice Jim Edgar was careful to say there is that I cannot control the economy. The fact of the matter is no governor and no president can control the economy. They are all either victims of it in bad times or they take advantage of it in good times. They always want credit for things going right when the economy is strong, as we saw Bill Clinton do very effectively in the 90s. And if it's going badly, they say, well, look, I can't control those kind of circumstances, but we're going to do our best to try to work our way through it. Jim Thompson had a program called Build Illinois, you may remember, which was building highways and bridges and making road improvements all over the state and doing a lot of other public works projects. I don't think most people would argue with most of what was in that Build Illinois program, because people who live downstate know how many narrow bridges still need to be replaced and how many two-lane roads still need to be repaired or widened, that sort of thing. But the problem was that after Thompson put it in place and the legislature approved it, then the economy started going south and the revenue started going down. And then all of a sudden, they had to pull back some of the projects. I don't believe they ever really got all of the projects in Build Illinois done, because they had to back off. And then, of course, then came the change in the administrations. And when Jim Baker came in, he found himself inheriting a big deficit. So those things will happen time to time. Now, I'm not defending Jim Thompson, because to some extent, Jim Edgar is right that there is always overspending. But the problem that Jim Edgar doesn't explain is that Democrats and Republicans usually agree on the perks that they put into the budget. That's how you get the votes to pass the budget in the first place. So when I used to cover Springfield, I used to say, you know what, this business of waste and perks and stuff, it's an equal opportunity kind of excess, because both parties engage in it. They all know they engage in it, but at the right moments, they try to blame each other for it, you know. And it's just one of those things where government ebbs and flows, the economy ebbs and flows. When politicians are successful, it's usually because the economy has been so good. You know how successful Bill Clinton was? I mentioned that. Well, Richard M. Daley, when he first came into office in 89, he came in just before the big economic boom. And he really benefited from that a great deal, because the city's revenues were really up there, and he could take a lot of that money and spread it out into the neighborhoods. And with that came a response of loyalty and support from taxpayers who saw him doing things, so long as the money was spent wisely. So all politicians always benefit from the economy when it is good, and they always get criticized when it's bad. But the truth of the matter is they don't really control the economy at all. I remember Milton Friedman, a Nobel Prize laureate from the University of Chicago, once saying, whenever a government reacts on the economy to economic problems, you can always count on two things, he said. Number one, they always react too late, and number two, they always overreact. And he was suggesting that government usually makes it worse.
Let's talk with somebody else here. We have a caller in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
More or less on the same topic of the financial condition of the state, I wonder if I could, if you can give us I'll ask you sort of for policy suggestions from your experience of having dealt with the state. This is probably you don't usually go into from the point of view of making proposals or supporting proposals, but it seems to me that ever since Paul Simon ran for governor in I think it was 1972 or somewhere, and he made this more or less honest statement in his campaign for the Democratic nomination that the state was going to have to increase the income tax. And, of course, he was defeated then by Dan Walker for governor. And sort of ever since Dan Walker, we've had governors who come in and always sort of promise that taxes will never be increased, although there was, I forget whether it was Edgar or Thompson that put through, I think, a half percent increase. But ever since then, we've always, it's been felt by politicians that it was political death to even breathe the idea of raising the income tax, or as I would suggest, possibly trying to get a revision of the Constitution to allow for a progressive income tax. But what are your proposals? I think it's clear that the state has been strapped for money for many years.
I can make a couple of general observations. I don't believe it would be my role to get too specific. I think I would leave that up to the governor and the lawmakers. I'm not copping out on this by any means, but I strongly believe that it's up to them to decide what needs to be done. That's why we elect them. But I'll make a couple of general observations. First of all, you're right in how everybody runs away from the income tax, and my own personal view is that of all the taxes that government levies, the income tax is the fairest tax of all because it's based upon what you earn.
Yeah.
The property tax is the most onerous tax, and that's the reason why I felt for many years that we finally have to bite the bullet and we have to get the support of public schools out from under the property tax and try to switch it to the income tax, but with some assurance, though, that people would get the property tax relief that's promised. And I think there's a way to word that in the legislation, which forces the hand of the lawmakers and doesn't allow them to do anything else but give the break. Now, another thing, too, though, is that there is a lack of discipline in government when it comes to fiscal spending. There's too much attention on giving perks to this lawmaker or that lawmaker because it makes him more popular in his home district. And so by the time the budget gets passed, it's a giant Christmas tree with all of these decorations all over it, and pretty soon it collapses almost of its own weight. The lawmakers have developed a fancy title for this. They call it member initiatives. Well, let me tell you something. Member initiatives are nothing but pure, simple pork. And my complaint about this is not that some districts don't need money, but that there are no guidelines for how this money gets spent. All it does is get thrown in the budget, and pretty soon, what do you see? Well, you see things like $500,000 being given to the city of Waukegan to help build a statue honoring Jack Benny. Excuse me. Give me a break. Okay? That should be privately funded. And there's lots of other examples of where the money is just flat out misused, but it's thrown into the budget because that person's vote is needed to get the budget passed in the first place. And I think at some point, the leaders of both parties have to get together and in a bipartisan way say, you know what, we've got, for the good of the whole state and for the good of all of us, we've got to put some limits on this sort of thing. Now, one of the problems we have now is that we have one-party control in Springfield. We've got a Democrat who's governor. We've got Democrats controlling the Senate and the House. I got to tell you, no matter which party is in total control, it's bad to have things that way. It's when the cloud is even that justice gets done, not when one party or the other controls everything. That's part of the problem in Washington. Well, the Republicans are in control there. It's harder to get things done because it's harder to get the bipartisanship that's necessary to put good policy to work. So I'll make those general observations. We need more discipline, and what we've got to do is we've got to have people get around to the notion that we need some original thinking here. We need to have people who have the guts to come out and say, you know what? It's about time that if we want equality in the public schools across the state, that we start thinking about switching funding of schools to the income tax, take it off the property tax, but wording the legislation in a way where the taxpayers get the property tax break they're being promised.
Yep, thank you.
All right. Our guest this morning, Bob Crawford, a man who spent a long time, many years, covering politics in Illinois and in the city of Chicago, most of them working for WBBM Radio. He retired in 2001, and when he retired, he gave his audio archive over to the University of Illinois so it could be preserved and accessible there for people who were interested, people who were doing history, maybe sometimes people who just wanted to hear some voices out of the past. And we thought, well, it'd be fun to have Bob here and to talk a little bit about it and to play some things. And that's what we have done. And I've said more than once here that there's a lot of material here. So there are all kinds of directions we could have gone. But I went looking for things that I thought would be interesting. And one cut that I came across that I wanted to play was Adlai Stevenson. This is Adlai Stevenson III, son of the man who ran for president of the United States. He ran for governor. And I guess perhaps that jumped out at me because I thought, gosh, when was the last time we ever heard anything from Mr. Stevenson? He's, as far as I know, he's still with us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a consultant.
But as someone who it seemed like after that this was, you know, after he ran and after the big LaRouche deal, it seemed that he just vanished. He was just gone. So I thought, well, it'd be interesting to maybe give people a chance to hear from him once again.
It is so childish, so unnecessary, that even if I make an occasional innocent slip like that, it shouldn't end up dominating a campaign, distracting attention from the life and death questions that we face, and then reversing the images. I wasn't the antique dealer running for the governorship in the last campaign. I wasn't the one who couldn't say no to that teamster when he came bearing cash because I didn't want to embarrass him. You know, I hate to get into this because it seems so unnecessary. I'm the Marine Corps veteran, the one who volunteered for combat in Korea after getting out of college. He's the one who pleaded 4F, pleaded asthma. Why do we have to get into that? If I have to get into that, somebody else is going to come out the wimp in this campaign. I'm just not going to take it lying down anymore.
Now, as that last remark suggested, this was all about during the campaign where it was suggested that Adlai Stevenson, because of his low-key style of campaigning and his low-key conduct as a U.S. senator, somehow came off as looking like a wimp in politics. And, of course, you can see that Stevenson got real angry there because it was catching hold, and the talk show hosts were all making light of it. That's what really angered him. It took on a life of its own, the wimp factor is what it was called, and Stevenson fired back. That campaign, you may remember, ended up with a very, very, very close election, and Adlai Stevenson had tried to get a recount but was not successful in that effort. And to this day, whenever I talk to him about it, he believes that he won that election. And that somehow there were miscounts of votes that ended up with him just barely losing, and he did just barely lose. It was a heck of a campaign between Stevenson and Thompson, two very intelligent men, both of whom understood government, but very, very different in their personalities and in their styles.
Yeah, I think a lot of people maybe felt that they had a difficult time relating to Mr. Stevenson because he had this image of the intellectual. People thought he was an egghead. Mm-hmm. Probably saw the same thing about his dad, he just didn't have the common touch, and Thompson certainly did. That stuff he had down cold, and he was so it was Mr. Thompson that he was the antiques dealer that was Mr. Stevenson here was slamming in the slamming in that cut.
Yeah, right. And, you know, it's interesting. Adlai was very much like his father. And when his father ran against Dwight Eisenhower, not once but twice, Learned Hand, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in New York, who was very highly respected himself, had an interesting line one time when he was talking about the campaign. And he said, I knew all about Dwight Eisenhower. He had been a famous general in the war and everything. He said, I didn't know much about this man named Stevenson. So he said, I went out several times to hear him speak, and he said, I always noticed that he had his speeches very carefully researched. His facts were all in line. And whenever anything new happened, he always changed the speeches to account for the new development and to offer his views on that thing. And he said, when I saw how careful he was and what an intellect he was and how he analyzed issues and everything, he says, I finally decided that I needed to vote for Eisenhower because I didn't think Adlai could ever get elected.
Too smart. The man was too smart to be president of the United States. We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left. You talked about earlier about the fact that some of what you have here is people just being themselves, being funny, and there is a lot of humorous stuff here. And I thought maybe just we have a joke. We have at least one joke.
Okay.
That I thought we would play. This is Henry Hyde. So this is 22059. We thought we can close with a joke here. This is, again, Henry Hyde.
I enjoy the story of the two little kids who said to their grandfather, Grandpa, can you make a sound like a frog? He said, no, why do you ask? And they said, well, Grandma says when you croak, we go to Disneyland.
You know, that points up the importance of humor in politics. All politicians try to be funny, try to be witty. Some are better than others at it because they think it shows their human side and they want to be one of the guys, so to speak, and they believe it attracts voter support. There have actually been books written on political humor to show how politicians try to endear themselves to the voters with using wit. John F. Kennedy was very famous for getting off some funny lines, and Henry Hyde always started every speech that I ever heard him give with a joke, even if the speech was about a serious subject like the Clinton impeachment. He would always start by giving everybody a good laugh, and Harold Washington used to do the same thing, so politicians place great importance on having a sense of humor. The only thing is you've got to be careful. If you don't pull it off, it doesn't sound quite right. You've got to be good at it.
Yeah. Who do you think was the most entertaining, if you could put it in that terms, most entertaining politician that you covered?
Oh, you mean in terms of just lightheartedness and joking and everything? Well, I think probably John F. Kennedy comes to mind. He was really very funny. Everett Dirksen was very funny in that soft, drooling way. You know, very, very, very funny guy, the way he would make observations. So Kennedy and Dirksen, Harold Washington could be very funny at times. He liked to joke with reporters about patronage being dead, dead, dead. I jumped on its grave and I shouted, "Patronage, are you there?" And he said there was no answer because it's dead. Well, of course, he knew it wasn't dead, but he used to like to jibe reporters, you know, on that subject, you know, things like that. So lots of politicians are unintendedly funny. Like Richard M. Daley, we didn't have a chance to play it where he was inspecting restaurants and someone, for health conditions, and somebody asked him, well, you know, is this just a way of shaking them down for campaign contributions? And he said, for heaven's sakes, no. He said, you don't want a mouse in your sandwich, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that was really, very funny. Mm. And so from I've learned that politicians say the darndest things into an open microphone. But you know what? It's them practicing the art of being themselves. And I always viewed those kind of things as being refreshing because of what we talked about earlier, David, where so much is prepared dialogue, you know what I mean? And when something comes out that's natural, it's a breath of fresh air.
Well, there's lots more that you can hear as part of Bob's audio archive that's now being held by the University of Illinois. Actually, it's at Chicago. Is that
The archives, there are copies both at the library here in Urbana and also in Chicago. Yeah, there are copies at both places. And then there will soon be a third copy at the University of Illinois in Springfield.
Oh, good place for it.
Right.
Exactly. So you can go there and you can actually listen to it. And maybe on another day we could ask Bob to come back and we could talk some more because there's much more we could play. We definitely ought to play some material related to the big snowstorm. We could have Mike Bolandic and Jane Byrne. We could have them on. Well, thank you very much.
David, thank you very much. It's nice of you to have me.
Bob Crawford, longtime radio reporter from WBBM in Chicago. In 1995, he was inducted into the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame, and he retired in 2001 and gave his archives, audio archives, to the U of I.